And Barb and I would like to wish happy birthday to 5 of our Iris listeners this morning. Happy birthday on this March 1st to Dale Alderman of Des Moines, Daniel Westberg of Des Moines, Diane DeSmit of Humboldt, Roger Hemmingson of Neola, and Catherine Jepson of Marshalltown. Again, happy birthday, Dale Alderman of Des Moines, Daniel Westberg of Des Moines, Diane DeSmit of Humboldt, Roger Hemmingson of Neola, and Catherine Jepson of Marshalltown. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. Now we'll turn it back to Barb for a look at today's obituaries.
David Fisher, 75, passed away on the 25th, 2024, in West Des Moines, Iowa. He was born July 24 of 1948 in West Des Moines to his parents Tom and Rose. David grew up in Valley Junction. He worked for Iowa Power, Mid-American Energy, and Par Electric for many years. David was a proud member of the IBEW Local 55 and enjoyed many years of riding his Harley. After retirement, he enjoyed working outside and taking his dog, Winnie, for walks. David also enjoyed cheering on the Chicago Bears and the Iowa Hawkeyes. Most of all, he cherished his time with his friends and family. David is survived by son Dalton Lee Fisher, Bo Camp, and other loving families and friends. He's preceded in death by his parents, 5 sisters, and 2 brothers. Memorial contributions may be made to A. Hines, that's A-H-E-I-N-Z, 57, Animal Shelter, in loving memory of David Fisher. A celebration of life will be planned at a later date. Online condolences may be made at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Margaret Loren Marty King, 86, died peacefully Tuesday, February 27, 2024, at her home in Des Moines, surrounded by her daughters. The family will receive friends from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, March 3, at Isles Dunn's Chapel, where funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, March 4. Burial will follow at Avon Cemetery. Margaret was born November 5 of 1937 in Des Moines to Harold Q. and Lorene E. Nelson Bender. She was a graduate of Roosevelt High School and Simpson College. She was known for her philanthropy to many causes and her community, including St. John's United Methodist Church, Church Women United, PEO Chapter Q, Dar Jean Marie Cardinal Chapter, Daughters of the Nile, Beta Sigma Phi, PTA, Des Moines Audubon Society, Ducks Unlimited, and Polk County Election Board. Survivors include her daughters Susan A., Kenneth M., Rue, R-E-W, of Blue Springs, Missouri, and Linda E. King of Des Moines, grandson Cooper H. Rue of Blue Springs, Missouri. Margaret was preceded in death by her parents and her husband, Robert H. King. Memorial contributions may be made to Mayo Clinic. Online condolences at islescares.com.
And back to more local news from the Register. This headline, Iowa House votes to ban DEI programs at public universities and cap in-state tuition hikes at 3%. This story by Stephen Gruber Miller. The Iowa House lawmakers voted Thursday to require Iowa's 3 public universities to eliminate all staff positions that are focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion unless they are necessary to comply with state or federal law. They also voted to cap in-state tuition increases at 3% per year. The bill would also require the Iowa Board of Regents to include 2 state lawmakers as non-voting members. House lawmakers voted 56-39 Thursday to pass House File 2558, which Republicans named the Higher Education Reform Act of 2024. 6 Republicans, Representatives Chad Ingalls, a Republican from Randalia, Shannon Latham from Sheffield, Brian Losey of Bondurant, Brent Segrist from Council Bluffs, and Ray Sorensen from Greenfield, as well as David Young from Van Meter, joined Democrats in voting against the bill. The measure now goes to the Senate for consideration. Much of the discussion focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and University of Northern Iowa. The bill's floor manager, Representative Taylor Collins, a Republican from Minneapolis, said, "Whether they were created with good intentions or not, it has become clear that they are now ideological enforcement centers that suppress the pursuit of truth and, most importantly, merit." House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, a Democrat from Windsor Heights, said that she's concerned about political motivations behind the bill. She said, "This clearly is a political bill. It clearly is a bill that creates more inefficiencies, increases costs, reduces services, and puts the accreditation of our region's institutions at risk." The legislation's language on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs codifies a series of directives adopted by the Iowa Board of Regents in November. Those directives require UNI, Iowa State, and the University of Iowa, Iowa State, and UNI to restructure their university-wide DEI offices to eliminate any DEI functions that are not required for accreditation or to comply with the law. The universities must also eliminate any other DEI-focused positions not necessary for those reasons. And the three universities must take reasonable steps to assure that no student, employee, visitor, or applicant is required to disclose their pronouns or to submit a DEI statement or participate in DEI initiatives. The directives also require the universities to develop annual employee guidance for separating personal political advocacy from university business and to work to advance the diversity of intellectual and philosophical perspectives in faculty and staff applicant pools. And the universities must develop a policy, quote, that prohibits the consideration of race and other protected class characteristics during the admissions process. Iowa's public universities rely on the Regent Admission Index for applications, which does not consider race or gender. The bill would also require community colleges to adopt policies and procedures that prohibit the community college from discriminating against faculty, staff, or students who do not ascribe to diversity, equity, and inclusion ideologies. Confirst said the letters DEI have been politicized as a boogeyman. But she said the concepts are those of fairness and including those who are different. She said, "I don't think diversity, equity, and inclusion is something we should be afraid of. We should be eliminating or we should be villainizing." Let me read that again because I don't think I gave it quite the right emphasis. Confirst said, "I don't think diversity, equity, and inclusion is something we should be afraid of. We should be eliminating or we should be villainizing." The University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa would not be allowed to raise in-state tuition and fees by more than 3% each year without approval of the Iowa's Legislative Council. For incoming in-student undergraduate students beginning in the 2024-25 school year, the universities would not be allowed to raise tuition on a class of students for 4 years, meaning most students would see the same tuition rate for their entire undergraduate experience. The tuition freeze would not apply to out-of-state students, and there would be exceptions for students who enter the university with a significant number of credits or who remain enrolled longer than 4 years. The universities would also have to conduct a comprehensive review on how to reduce costs, maintain tuition at close to current levels, and keep non-instructional costs below 10% of the university's budget. Confirst, the Democrat from Windsor Heights, said that she has concerns about Republicans' proposal on tuition, although she appreciates the idea of a freeze. She said, "House Democrats introduced one as well. The difference is that this one does not do anything to backfill that money, does not do anything at the region's institutions to ensure that they won't have to cut programs, they won't have to cut faculty, that they won't have to cut things at that school." Collins said he believes the universities would still be able to support their operations if they're limited to a 3% tuition increase. He said, "I think the 3% increase is very reasonable for the students. It's sustainable for the institution as well." The bill would also expand the Iowa Board of Regents by adding two state lawmakers as non-voting members of the currently 9-person board. One lawmaker would be chosen by the Senate Majority Leader, and one would be chosen by the House Speaker. It would also alter the process for choosing new presidents of the three public universities by requiring the Board of Regents to use a presidential search committee made up of members of the Board of Regents. The bill would keep confidential the identity of any candidate for a university president position by specifying that the person's identity is not a public record. The Iowa Senate would also gain the power to confirm by their colleagues. Regents are already subject to Senate confirmation after being nominated by the governor. Collins said having lawmakers included as non-voting members on the Board of Regents, quote, gives this body increased oversight of higher education. Representative Adam Zabner, a Democrat from Iowa City, said the bill isn't focused on the issues facing students, like declining state funding for higher education. He said, "I talk to a lot of students at the University of Iowa. They make up a lot of my district, and they often bring concerns about things that are happening in state government. Not one of them has ever said, what we really need is more politicians on the Board of Regents." The Iowa Board of Regents would have to approve the hiring of any administrator positions at the University of Iowa, Iowa State, or UNI. The University of Iowa, ISU, and UNI would not be able to hire any new administrator positions without approval from the Board of Regents. The three universities would be able to fill open administrator positions with another administrator who is already employed at the university. And lastly, all students at the state's public universities would be required to complete a course on American history and civics before graduating if this bill becomes law. That requirement would apply to all undergraduate students admitted during or after the 2024-25 school year. The bill states, "The curriculum shall focus on the founding of the United States and shall emphasize the Federalist Papers, the United States Constitution, and the three branches of government."
Now, an analysis from Susan Page entitled "McConnell Never a Classic Politician." Mitch McConnell is someone who apparently rejects grand oratory as unseemly and has perfected a facial expression that betrays no emotion beyond a certain sour skepticism. Yet he became the largest serving Senate party leader in history, holding power through some of the most tumultuous times of the Republican Party. He has reshaped the federal judiciary and defined the grand ambitions of more than one Democratic president. That made McConnell's speech on the Senate floor Wednesday surprising, not only because he announced he was stepping down from his leadership post in November. During his remarks, the 7-term Kentucky senator was introspective and even emotional, his voice catching, a figure at odds with the caricature of him as the hard-edged calculator of political advantage. He mentioned the recent death of a sister of his wife, former Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao. When you lose a loved one, particularly at a young age, there's a certain introspection that accompanies the grieving process, said McConnell. Perhaps it is God's way of reminding you of your own life's journey to reprioritize the impact of the world that we all inevitably leave behind. I turned 82 last week, and the end of my contributions are closer than I'd prefer. His view that it's time to step back isn't shared by some others of the political generation. President Joe Biden is now running for a second term at age 81. Former President Donald Trump is seeking a return to the White House at age 77. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, is 73. But McConnell is now the highest-ranking elected official in a Republican Party that he may no longer feel comfortable in or recognize. It has been more than 3 years since he even spoke with Trump, the face of the GOP, who is poised to win the party's third consecutive nomination for the White House. Indeed, among leading Republicans, McConnell is the most influential holdout to endorsing the former president, a political gesture that is reportedly the subject of negotiations between Trump's team and his own. When Trump burst on the political scene in 2016, McConnell matter-of-factly endorsed him once it became clear that the real estate mogul and the reality TV star was going to win the GOP nomination. At the time, McConnell told USA Today that he saw no political percentage in the Republicans trying to distance themselves from the presumptive nominee. My view is that Trump will not change the Republican Party, McConnell said then. If he brings in new followers, that's great and well worth the effort, but he will not change the Republican Party. On that, at least, McConnell acknowledged that he turned out to be wrong. Believe me, I know the politics within my party, and at this time, he said Wednesday at the state Senate floor, I have many faults. Misunderstanding politics is not one of them. McConnell has been a skilled legislator, known for holding his cards close to his vest. One political strength is his willingness to be ridiculed and denounced by his foes. He never seemed to particularly care what anyone except his fellow Republican senators thought of his work. And he earned the particular enmity of Democrats when he refused to let the Senate consider the confirmation of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court after President Barack Obama nominated him. And he then worked with the Trump administration to confirm three Supreme Court justices and a filings on consecutive judges to federal courts. He broke with Trump when the former president refused to accept his loss in the 2020 election, and he held Trump responsible for the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, but he also voted against impeaching him. On national security policy, McConnell now finds himself battling the American first instincts of Trump and a rising tide of House Republicans. At a White House meeting, the other congressional leaders Tuesday with them, he forcefully urged continued U.S. aid to Ukraine in its war against Russia. The assistance is included in a measure that has passed the Senate but faces uncertain prospects in the House. McConnell's health has also been a subject of concern. He suffered a concussion in a serious fall last year, and while speaking to reporters, he has frozen briefly in episodes that were never fully explained. One of life's most unappreciated talents is to know when it's time to move on to life's next chapter, he said Wednesday. He plans to serve out his Senate term, which ends in January of 27, more than four decades after he was first sworn in during the Reagan presidency in 1985. Father Time remains undefeated, he said. I am no longer the young man sitting in the back hoping colleagues would remember my name. It is time for the next generation of leadership. But he added, I still have enough gas in the tank to thoroughly disappoint my critics, and I intend to do so with all the enthusiasm which they have become accustomed.
This story from page 6A of today's Des Moines Register. Court's timing in appeal is a win for Trump. Meanwhile, Illinois is the latest to bar him from the ballot. This story by USA Today, Dateline Washington. The Supreme Court on Wednesday said it'll decide whether former President Donald Trump can be tried for trying to steal the 2020 election, setting an accelerated schedule to hear the case in April while his criminal trial remains delayed. The court will hear arguments the week of April 22nd on whether a president can be charged criminally for conduct that involved official acts while he was in the White House. The move is a win for Trump, who is appealing a lower court's decision that he is not immune from prosecution. Even if Trump loses that appeal, the Supreme Court may not reach a decision quickly enough for a trial to proceed in time for a verdict before the November election. Trump said in a statement, "Without presidential immunity, a president will not be able to properly function or make decisions in the best interest of the United States of America." Special Counsel Jack Smith, who had asked for a faster schedule if the justices did want to consider Trump's immunity, has told the court that the public interest in a prompt trial is at its zenith. Smith's office declined comment. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney and now a law professor at the University of Michigan, said setting oral arguments in late April seems awfully slow. She said the case can still be tried before election if they hustle the decision. Otherwise, justice delayed is justice denied. Paul Schiff Berman, a law professor at George Washington University, called it completely unjustifiable for the court to keep Trump's trial on hold while it considers his appeal. Berman said, "There's no reason that lower court proceedings could not continue in the meantime, and if the court ultimately rules that Trump is immune, the proceedings could be discontinued at that time." Berman said he would not expect a Supreme Court decision until the end of June, which means that a trial is unlikely to begin until end of summer at the earliest. Trump's immunity appeal is just one of the issues the High Court is deciding that will affect his future. The justices are also considering a challenge to how federal prosecutors are going after January 6, 2021 rioters in a case that could affect the federal charges against Trump. And they're also deciding whether an anti-insurrectionist provision of the Constitution can be used by states to kick Trump off their ballots. On Wednesday, Illinois joined Colorado and Maine in barring Trump from the state's 2024 ballots over his alleged role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Cook County Circuit Judge Tracy Porter agreed with Illinois activists who say that Trump should be disqualified from serving as president again because a section of the 14th Amendment, enacted after the Civil War, blocks people from office who had engaged in insurrection after previously promising to support the Constitution. Trump argues the amendment does not apply to former presidents, and even if it does, he says he did not engage in insurrection. Judge Porter delayed her ruling from taking effect in anticipation of a U.S. Supreme Court decision. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, said the Supreme Court is putting itself on trial. Pelosi said it remains to be seen whether the justices will uphold the fundamental American value that no one is above the law, not even a former president. Trump, the likely Republican presidential nominee, has sought to delay four federal and state criminal cases until after the election. If voters return Trump to the White House while the trial is still pending, he could ask the Justice Department to dismiss pending federal cases against him. Special prosecutor Jack Smith had asked the Supreme Court to weigh in early on the immunity issue, which the justices, without comment, declined to do in December. After the appeals court ruled against Trump, his lawyers tried to use Smith's arguments to their benefit. They reminded the Supreme Court that Smith had said the case presents a fundamental question at the heart of our democracy that only the Supreme Court can definitively resolve. Smith told the court this month that if the Supreme Court did not want to take up the issue before, there was less of a reason to do so now since the appeals court soundly rejected Trump's immunity claim. But if the justices did not want to consider the immunity claim, he continued, they should do so quickly to minimize the continued trial delay. Smith had asked the appeal to be argued in March, a month earlier than the court's April 22nd schedule. The trial on the special counsel's charges against Trump was originally scheduled for March. Trump's lawyers had argued restarting the federal trial on election interference would sideline Trump from the 2024 campaign, threatening the First Amendment rights of the tens of millions of American voters who are entitled to hear his campaign message. Trump has pleaded not guilty to four federal charges in the case for falsely claiming election fraud and trying to overturn the legitimate election results. While former presidents have broad immunity from civil lawsuits for official actions taken while serving in the White House, Trump has attempted to claim sweeping immunity from criminal prosecution. A three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals last month definitively rejected Trump's argument in a unanimous opinion. After rejecting Trump's claim of absolute immunity, the appeals panel said it wasn't necessary to determine whether the criminal allegations covered official acts. But an appeals panel already found campaign activity is not an official act. When Capitol Police officers sued Trump for allegedly inciting the Capitol attack, another appeals panel ruled that actions constituting re-election campaign activity are not official and can be the basis for a lawsuit.
Fire grows to largest in Texas history by Osterman, Weiss, and Santucci. Wildfires continued burning across the Texas panhandle on Thursday, forcing widespread evacuations and causing one death as one blaze became the largest in the state's history. As of Thursday morning, 130 fires were burning across the state, according to Texas A&M Fire Service. The largest of them is the Smokehouse Creek Fire. It had consumed 1 million acres, an area larger than the state of Rhode Island, and has just 3% contained. The already massive inferno grew when the 687 Reamer fire fed into it after consuming an additional 2,000 acres of land. This is now the largest fire on record for Texas, said Aaron O'Connor, who's the lead public information officer for the Forest Service Thursday. The fire's acreage indicates land within the burn zone, she said. And meanwhile, the Windy Deuce fire had burned across at least 140,000 acres and was 30% contained. O'Connor said that there had only been one death officially caused by the fires, 83-year-old Joyce Blankenship of a small town of Stinnett. And the number of structures that have been damaged is not really known, though teams are investigating. The fire service said the potential for wildfires could relax later in the week, but would increase on the Texas plains amid strong winds. And the governor, Abbott, directed the Texas Division of Emergency Management to increase its readiness in response to the fires. Those strong winds combined with the dry environment fueled by unseasonably high temperatures allowed the fire to grow rapidly. On Tuesday, the fires forced an evacuation of a nuclear weapon plant northeast of Amarillo, causing officials at the plant to halt operations that evening, and the plant resumed normal operations on Wednesday. According to a report last year by the Texas climatologists, a wildfire risk in the state is projected to increase due to increased rates of drying and fuel load. Texas typically has two fire seasons, one in the winter, another in the summer. The winter season runs February through April. The summer wildfire season is August through October. And intense rains create larger than usual amounts of shrub, grass, and brush growth during the droughts. That was the case with the Bastrop fire in 2011. Before the Smokehouse Creek fire took a title, the largest fire in Texas, the largest was an East Amarillo complex fire. The fire ignited in Hutchinson County. It also caused 13 fatalities, making the deadliest in the state's history. Historically, slightly more than 1% of the state's land has burned each decade since 84, and climate models project that to increase, and it will increase as soil and vegetation becomes drier. On Thursday, fire activity was minimal, in part because of winds died down, and also some precipitation is forecast for this week, and that could help. Our firefighters should be able to make good progress and increase containment over the next couple of days.
And for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb Martin and Dave Buzik. It's been our pleasure to read for you. We'll take a short break now to allow our next readers to get into place here in the studio. Have a good weekend.
And we're back. Your new readers are Scott Splavik, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Scott with our next article.
Thank you, Rachel. We'll start with the first opinion, written by Barbara Streisand and Dr. Noel Barry Mers. And Dr. Noel Barry Mers is the director of the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center in the Schmidt Heart Institute at Cedars-Sinai and a scientific advisor to Women's Heart Alliance. And it's entitled, Gender Gap in Heart Disease Kills Us. February was American Heart Month, when cardiovascular disease, the number one killer of women, gets its moment in the spotlight. Every year, when this month comes around, as co-founders of a women's heart health organization dedicated to fighting gender inequity in cardiovascular research, treatment, and prevention, we wonder the same thing. How far have we come? Yes, we've made progress. After years of stagnation, sex-specific research is steadily increasing. We funded the first large-scale heart disease outcome trial in women, aptly named Warrior, with results due later this year. There's a greater understanding of the biological differences between men's and women's hearts. Yet gaps remain. Awareness of heart disease is on the decline among women, especially younger ones, who are at increased risk. Only 38% of clinical trial participants are women, and research is chronically underfunded. Fewer than 20% of Americans' medical schools have sex and gender-based curriculum that goes beyond obstetrics and gynecology. And women are more concerned about other parts of our bodies, when in fact the heart, our very essence, is at higher risk. There's another factor contributing to heart disease's stubborn hold, and it's dangerously under-discussed. Heart disease in women is often completely missed or its diagnosis delayed. Confusion surrounding the unique signs of heart disease in women, compounded by systemic issues, has created a crisis of misdiagnosis. Even when presenting with symptoms of heart disease or cardiac distress, women are too often told it's all in their head. Fixing this problem will require more and better action from doctors, medical schools, policymakers, and women themselves. While there's scant data on the overall impact, there's little doubt that misdiagnosis is all too common. Here's what we've heard women say. Quote, the EMT advised me to breathe into a bag. He said I was having a panic attack. End quote. Quote, a cardiologist said to me, young lady, I've been doing this for 30 years. I am telling you, it's not your heart. I'm going to send you back to your doctor to have your nerves checked. End quote. Another quote, a doctor told me that my arm pain was tennis elbow and to wear a brace. In fact, I was having a heart attack. These are the stories of real women who have been misdiagnosed with near deadly consequences. It's impossible to capture the voices of the women who fell off, went to the hospital, were sent home, and died of a heart attack in their sleep. Misdiagnosis is a crisis hiding in plain sight. Women presenting with symptoms of heart disease are routinely dismissed, gaslighted, or given a mental health diagnosis. Because women's symptoms of heart disease can be subtle and differ from men's, missed or delayed diagnosis can result not only by healthcare professionals, but also among women who aren't aware of the signs to look out for. At the heart of misdiagnoses are profound gender disparities. Just a little over half of physicians and cardiologists report they feel prepared to diagnose a heart attack in women. Women are less likely than men to be admitted to the hospital, receive thorough evaluations that can identify heart problems, or be given life-saving procedures. More women than men die within a year of having a heart attack, and women, especially women of color, wait an average of 11 minutes longer to see a physician than men who reported chest pain. Misdiagnosis is a personal affront and infuriating example of how women are often not heard and our health concerns dismissed or belittled. It comes from systemic issues, inherent bias in healthcare, how medicine is taught, underfunding of gender-specific research, and an old guard of doctors who can't or won't advocate for change. Rushed healthcare professionals have less time to make an accurate diagnosis, and many patients have limited or no access to heart specialists. And yes, it's also because women don't know enough about cardiovascular disease to connect what's going on in our bodies with our hearts. We often downplay symptoms, blaming stress, menopause, or aging, or just ignore the warning signs completely. Misperceptions that heart disease is an older problem also abound, with chilling implications for young women who have worse outcomes following a heart attack and tend to wait longer to seek treatment. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of pregnancy-related mortality in the United States, endangering the lives of young women, especially women of color. Ending the crisis of mixed diagnosis cannot and should not rest solely on women's shoulders, but greater awareness and self-advocacy can go a long way toward prevention. Knowing the unique signs and symptoms of a heart attack in women, chest pain or pressure, jaw, throat, back, arm or neck pain, shortness of breath, extreme fatigue, nausea or vomiting, heartburn or indigestion is critically important, as is being specific and direct with healthcare professionals when experiencing symptoms. On a systemic level, we also need more gender-specific research on cardiovascular disease. The White House Initiative on Women's Health Research, led by First Lady Jill Biden and the White House Gender Policy Council, hopes to fill significant gaps in research with the goal of better understanding how to diagnose, treat, and prevent cardiovascular disease in women. We also need to better integrate sex and gender differences into medical school curricula. Given that heart disease is the leading killer of women, it should be a requirement that every medical student learn what we've known for years, that women's hearts are different from men's. Lastly, we are calling for a nationwide public health campaign to make sure that heart disease awareness and prevention messages reach every corner of America. Most of us don't know our risks, and it's killing us. Let's change that. American women deserve better. And again, this opinion was written by Barbara Streisand and Dr. Noel Barry Mers.
Thank you, Scott. The second opinion piece on the USA Today opinion page is titled, How Social Media Ruling Could Affect You. This is written by Jennifer Huddleston, who is a technology policy research fellow at the Cato Institute, and also an adjunct professor at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. She writes, if you read or post in the comments sections accompanying your online news, the U.S. Supreme Court may soon give you a lot to comment about, but fewer places to do it. The same diminishing access may apply if you debate with friends and family on Facebook, enjoy sharing memes on X, formerly known as Twitter, leave reviews on Yelp, or even list products for sale on Etsy. A lot of the everyday online platforms that many of us use to connect with friends and family, gain information, or run a business provide a place to create user-generated content. As a result, most platforms require some degree of content moderation around what is or isn't allowed. Laws in Texas and Florida could change how platforms can handle such content, making them less likely to offer such opportunities for expression to users, which would impact far more than just social media. The good news is the Supreme Court is considering challenges to these laws and the possibility that they violate the First Amendment. Justices on Monday held oral arguments in the cases of NetChoice versus Paxton and Moody versus NetChoice, each of which tests the constitutionality of the two states' social media laws. Texas prohibits social media platforms with more than 50 million active U.S. users from censoring a user, a user's expression, or a user's ability to receive the expression of another person. And its law prevents online services from engaging in content moderation, except in a few specific instances. Florida seeks to admit large social media platforms. Florida seeks to limit large social media platforms with annual gross revenues in excess of $100 million and at least 100 million monthly individual platform participants globally from willfully deplatforming a political candidate. Along with other provisions on public contracts, the law aims to categorize big social media platforms as common carriers. These cases arrived at the Supreme Court after lower courts came to different conclusions on the constitutionality of the two similar laws. In Moody v. NetChoice, the 11th Circuit ruled that Florida's provisions on content moderation and disclosure requirements limit platforms' ability to exercise editorial judgment, therefore triggering First Amendment scrutiny. Meanwhile, in NetChoice v. Paxton, the 5th Circuit ruled that large social media platforms do not have a First Amendment right to censor speech, finding a sufficient state interest to regulate the platform's conduct. Now the Supreme Court is considering the question, do the content moderation restrictions and transparency requirements placed by Texas and Florida laws each violate the First Amendment rights of the large social media platform these laws seek to regulate? Though a great deal of emphasis will be placed on the platform's First Amendment rights, those rights also will impact the user experience. It may be easy to think that requiring platforms to permit certain users or content would help ensure that free speech continues to flourish, or that minority viewpoints are not crowded out, but these proposals would create new concerns not only for platforms, but also for users. For example, under the Texas law, a platform serving the Jewish community that fits the law's provisions would not be able to remove lawful but awful anti-Semitic content. Under the Florida law, anyone could register to run for, say, local dog catcher and proceed to share videos of animal cruelty, and social media platforms would be unable to respond. The Supreme Court hearing raised important questions about what these laws would mean, not only for traditional social media, but also a LinkedIn virtual job fair, or if Etsy wanted to limit discussion of politics on its platforms. As Justice Sonia Sotomayor noted to Florida's Solicitor General, quote, "It seems like your law is covering just about every social media platform on the internet," end quote. The ways these laws apply to the content moderation needed for user-generated content means that they won't just affect social media, but also such things as review sites, comment sections on articles, and even online listings. As the Supreme Court noted, while the Texas law is narrower, the Florida law could affect even such platforms as Uber. Some platforms might just choose not to carry user-generated content anymore, given the risk. Others might eliminate the opportunity to discuss certain topics or offer certain products that are perceived as having a viewpoint, although the internet often illustrates that almost anything can become a vehemently held belief and viewpoint. While the Texas law is narrower on what platforms it covers, it remains vague on what constitutes a viewpoint in a way that could eliminate any number of both serious and more fanciful internet debates on everything from the upcoming election to Taylor Swift's impact on the NFL. While some will try to make the NetChoice cases only about big tech or social media, the reality is that the Supreme Court's decision will have an impact not just the companies, but also everyday internet users. Again, that's by Jennifer Huddleston, who is a technology policy research fellow.
All right, now we'll move on to sports, and we'll start with what's on TV today. At 5:30 p.m. on FS1, you can catch the NASCAR Xfinity Series qualifying round from the Las Vegas Motor Speedway in Las Vegas, Nevada. 8 p.m., on FS1, it's the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series, Victoria's Voice Foundation 200, presented by Westgate Resorts Las Vegas Motor Speedway in Las Vegas. Men's college basketball, 5 p.m. on the CBS Sports Network. It's Bowling Green at Ohio. 6 p.m. on ESPNU. It's Fairfield at Marist. 8 p.m. on ESPN2. You can catch Dayton at Loyola Chicago. 9:30 p.m. on the CBS Sports Network. It's Fresno State at Nevada. And at 10 p.m. on FS1, Air Force at Utah State. MLB baseball, spring training at noon. You can catch the Mets versus the St. Louis Cardinals from Jupiter, Florida. That's on the MLB Network. 7 p.m. on the MLB Network. It's a spring training game. Cleveland versus Los Angeles. NBA basketball, 6:30 p.m. on ESPN. It's Dallas at Boston. And at 9 p.m. on ESPN, Milwaukee at Chicago. NFL, if you're into watching the Combine, at 2 p.m., the NFL Scouting Combine, defensive backs and tight ends. And in hockey, NHL on the NHL Network at 6 p.m., it's Philadelphia at Washington. I'll read the top story on the sports page. I know... an article was read about Caitlin Clark earlier, but I'll go ahead and read this one as well. Iowa star Clark declares for WNBA draft. It's written by Dargan Southern of the Des Moines Register. Caitlin Clark, with one more regular season game remaining plus the postseason, has set a finish line on her Iowa women's basketball career. Ahead of Senior Day Sunday against Ohio State, Clark announced Thursday afternoon that she will enter the 2024 WNBA draft and will not return to Iowa for her COVID year of eligibility. Clark is widely expected to be the number one overall pick of the Indiana Fever on draft day, which is April 15th. While the season is far from over and we have a lot more goals to achieve, it will be my last one at Iowa, Clark wrote in her farewell post on social media. It is impossible to fully express my gratitude to everyone who has supported me during my time at Iowa, my teammates who made the last 4 years the best, my coaches, trainers, and staff who always let me be me, Hawkeye fans who filled Carver Hawkeye every night, and everyone who came out to support us across the country, especially the young kids. Most importantly, none of this would have been possible without my family and friends who have been by my side through it all. Because of all of you, my dreams came true. When asked throughout the season about her WNBA future, Clark calmly deflected the question and emphasized her focus on this season. But the noise was only going to grow louder as Iowa's season winds down. Cementing a decision before this campaign reaches full intensity will allow Clark and the Hawkeyes to operate with a clear mind in March. Clark's Iowa career will finish nothing short of legendary. She owns the scoring record for NCAA women's basketball, major women's college basketball, and soon all of Division I basketball. The homegrown superstar from West Des Moines delivered on her promise to take Iowa back to the Final Four for the first time since 1993. Another trip there in a few weeks would only further this incredible legacy. Either way, Clark's career at Iowa will forever be transcendent for many different reasons.
We have just a couple of minutes before Dear Abby, but just the highlights of the State 5A girls basketball. Johnston back in state title game after victory over Waukee. Johnston's Ailey Tankey stepped outside the three-point line just to the right of the top of the key and let off a shot. It sank through the net with ease as Tankey jogged to the opposite end of the court. Over the first 2.5 minutes of the second half, Tankey scored 8 straight points. The Dragons' defense backed up her scoring success, holding the Waukee girls basketball team without a field goal for over 5 minutes in the third quarter. Tankey's scoring streak proved to be the final push that Johnston, which is 25-0, really needed to get past Waukee, which is 19-5, in the Iowa High School State Basketball Class 5A semifinal game. And then, Dowling advances to the 5A final with the win over Cedar Falls. Katie Muller grabbed a pass from Ava Zedeker just seconds into the second half of Thursday's Iowa girls basketball state semifinal game between Dowling and Cedar Falls. The Maroons freshman took a second to settle, then let off the shot from beyond the arc. It sailed through the hoop, and less than 30 seconds later, she added another 3. Muller's back-to-back buckets from beyond the arc gave Dowling the momentum it needed as it sparked the Maroons to pull ahead by double digits in their 59-48 win over Cedar Falls. So, those highlights from the girls' basketball tournament. It's time to turn to Dear Abby. There are 3 letters today, so I'll read the first 2 and you take the last one, Scott? Okay. Dear Abby, my husband has a poor relationship with our son and his wife. They want nothing to do with him and don't want him around the grandchildren because of how he acts. My husband tells me I should stick up for him and tell them what they're doing is wrong and that he would never do or say anything bad in front of the grands. My son and his wife have made their decision. If I send them a text or visit them, it causes fights in our house because he is not welcome. Now my husband is demanding that I choose. Stand by him and have nothing to do with the kids, or choose the kids and have nothing more to do with him. How fair is it to have to make a choice like that? Signed, Torn in Florida. Abby says, Dear Torn, fairness has nothing to do with it. Your husband is trying to blackmail you into running interference for him with your son. It's time to decide which is more important, having a relationship with your son, his wife, and your grandchildren, or remaining with your controlling, unpleasant husband. Keep doing what you're doing and call his bluff, because disengaging from you could be more complicated and expensive than your husband realizes. The second letter, Dear Abby, I am writing because my wife has lost interest in her appearance. I love her, but I cannot figure out a way to tell her she has become obese. She seems to think her appearance is just fine. I know I can't say anything without her getting extremely upset, so I'm in a quandary about how to get her to understand that obesity is not only a danger to her health, but also looks awful. Can you suggest a way to approach a woman without getting in deep trouble with her? I'm sure other men and women have this similar situation. Please advise. Signed, Worried Husband. The message might be, Abby writes, Dear Husband, the message might be less unwelcome if you concentrate solely on the health aspect of her weight gain. Encourage her to see her doctor, begin exercising with you if necessary, and adopt a healthy diet for both of you, because you love her and want to enjoy many more happy years together.
Our final Dear Abby letter is, Dear Abby, a relative recently moved to my state and wants to get together more than I care to. This person had more than a year to prepare for the move, but didn't plan ahead and now is overwhelmed, needy, whiny, and complaining constantly. I'm now being asked for information regarding many of the personal services I use. My relative talks over me and doesn't listen, so conversation is difficult. Aside from not initiating calls or answering my phone, have you any suggestions about how I can limit my interactions with this person? Signed, Keeping to Myself. Dear Keeping, email or text a list of resources they can use to acclimate to the community. I'm thinking pharmacy, dry cleaners, specialty stores, etc. And after that, be busy. very busy.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Friday, March 1st. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Scott Splavik. Earlier, you heard Barb Martin and Dave Busick. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.